Chapter 26 Around the River Bend. Most people have never heard of the Shoshone Indians of the Great Basin in western North America. More's the pity, for their way of life had a profound influence on how a whole generation of American archaeologists thought about the past. Unlikely heroes, the Shoshone people lived in small bands in one of the driest landscapes in the United States. They ate small game and plant foods of many kinds, used only the simplest of digging sticks, grinders, and bows and arrows, yet thrived in a very harsh, arid environment for thousands of years. Why were they so successful? Anthropologist Julian Stewart, 1902 to 1972, who was very aware of archaeology, spent many months with the Shoshone. He attributed their success to their constant mobility and to their remarkable knowledge of the available foods in what he called an edible, if very dry, landscape. The Shoshone moved across the Great Basin landscape constantly, their movements dictated by food and water supplies. In a classic anthropological study, Stewart mapped how their patterns of settlement changed from one season to the next. But he was no narrowly focused anthropologist. He realized that changing settlement patterns across different landscapes were key to understanding ancient societies. His approach became known as cultural ecology, the study of the relationship between people and their environments. Much of Stewart's career brought him in touch with archaeologists through a huge archaeology project on the Missouri River, known as the River Basin Surveys Program, which began after the Second World War. During the 1950s and early 1960s, a surge in dam construction began to transform the United States and archaeology. The large-scale waterworks provided hydroelectric power, stored water for agriculture, controlled floods, and expanded navigation on major rivers. But they also destroyed thousands of archaeological sites. The most ambitious project involved harnessing the Missouri River. This would drown 1,600 kilometers of valley land and destroy over 90% of the historical and archaeological sites along the river. The River Basin surveys developed as archaeologists fought to salvage the past. Such surveys transformed American archaeology beyond recognition. Previously, most research had unfolded in limited areas like the Southwest. By the time the program ended, we had the first portrait of an ancient North America, far more diverse than merely burial mounds and pueblos. The scale of the Missouri River dam building and survey operations alone was enormous. There were still only very few qualified archaeologists available to do the survey work. 12 universities, 4 museums, and various other organizations joined in at once. By 1968, when the River Basin surveys ended, hard-working field workers had surveyed about 500 reservoir basins, big and small. They had tested more than 20,000 archaeological sites. Many of them filled in blanks on the archaeological maps, for the surveys examined hitherto unknown areas. Nearly 2,000 significant reports came from the surveys. An avalanche of new data, in the form of artifacts and other finds, descended on archaeological laboratories around the country. Perhaps most important of all, many archaeologists became aware of the threat to the fragile archives they relied upon. Excavation destroyed sites, and so they also came to believe that digging was a last resort. Ever since the surveys ended, most archaeology in the United States has been devoted to conserving the record of the past that remains. Many young American archaeologists serve their apprenticeships on the River Basin surveys and on projects in the Southeast funded by the Works Project Administration. They surveyed threatened landscapes and digging sites before they vanished underwater. The sheer number of artifacts, many of them from sites occupied over long periods, was overwhelming. Bag after bag of stone tools and pot fragments had to be washed, labeled, and classified. The people who undertook this work confronted a problem similar to that of Christian Jurgensen Thomsen in Copenhagen 150 years earlier. See Chapter 9. how did you create a chronological framework for America's remote past? There was no three-age system in North America. Some River Basin Survey's archaeologists devoted their entire careers to this past. One of them was James A. Ford, an artifact expert who assembled hundreds of collections from thousands of sites into long, elaborate charts that extended over thousands of years. I recall sitting through one of his presentations, complete with graphs and flip charts. Ford was not an interesting lecturer. This was long before computers, and his endless stream of data was unintelligible and boring. I must confess that I dozed off. Much archaeology of the day was obscure, bogged down in minute changes in artifacts, and nothing more than a framework of changing technologies. Fortunately, a few scholars approached their work with a broader perspective, a determination to move away from pure data to the study of ancient people. Gordon Randolph Willey, 1913-2002, was one such visionary. He was destined to become one of the best-known archaeologists of the 20th century. Willey worked on the River Basin surveys and on another survey in northwestern Florida while still a student. The experience gave him not only a grounding in artifacts of many kinds, but also an understanding of how people adapted to changing landscapes over thousands of years. Willey served as an anthropologist at the Bureau of American Ethnology at the Smithsonian Institution from 1943 to 1950. While there, he worked on the River Basin surveys in the southeastern United States. He collaborated with Ford and others on a series of reports that raised the study of culture history, see Chapter 23, to new levels. This work was far more sophisticated than Kidder's work at Pecos in the Southwest 30 years earlier, see Chapter 24. During his survey years, he worked closely with Julian Steward, who told Willey and others that they should stop examining single sites and look at people and their settlements in the context of their landscapes. When he finished with the surveys, Willey had almost unrivaled experience of archaeological survey work in the field. But as well as being an archaeologist, he was also an anthropologist. His training had combined the two, for his teachers made it clear that you could not study ancient North Americans without taking account of living Indian societies as well. In North America, archaeology was not only excavation and survey, but also anthropology. Steward strongly encouraged Willey to carry out an archaeological survey in one of the river valleys of the arid north coast of Peru. He helped him set up a project to study the varied landscape and changing prehistoric settlement patterns in the little-known Viru Valley. Willey looked at the entire valley with the help of aerial photographs, images taken from the air. He surveyed the most promising areas on foot and carried out limited excavations. In his report on the project, published in 1953, he told the story of the valley as a series of ever-changing complex economic, political, and social landscapes. Stratigraphic sequences and artifacts were but a small part of the story. Willey's Viru research founded what is now called settlement archaeology, an important strand in today's archaeological world. The Viru research earned Willey the prestigious Bowditch Professorship of Central American and Mexican Archaeology at Harvard University in 1950. He worked there for the rest of his career, carrying out important field work on the Maya civilization. He also worked on settlement surveys at important sites in Belize and Guatemala. The emphasis of his research was not on major cities, but on the lesser settlements that flourished in their shadows. Gordon Willey was a charming, learned archaeologist and a superb mentor of young students. Above all, he stressed that good archaeology is based on data, not just on high-flown ideas. As we shall see in later chapters, this was an important point. Willey was not, of course, alone. There were other larger-than-life figures who worked in North America during this time. Jesse David Jennings, 1909-97. Was a major figure in the archaeology of the American West. Jennings joined the University of Utah in 1948. His first field research in the Great Basin involved excavating several dry cave sites, especially Danger Cave, so named because a falling rock nearly killed two archaeologists. Here he excavated 4 meters of occupation levels with painstaking care. They revealed an estimated 11,000 years of occasional visitations. Preservation conditions in the dry levels were near perfect, allowing Jennings to study the small adjustments the inhabitants had made to changing climatic conditions in the area. At the time the cave was occupied, there had been nearby marshes where fish, edible plants, and waterfowl abounded. Jennings found cords made from plant fibers, leather clothing fragments, basketry, and stones used for grinding nuts. He even excavated well-preserved beetle remains and human feces, which revealed much about the predominantly plant diet of the inhabitants. He wrote of a long-lived cultural tradition, which endured until AD 500. Like Willey and Ford in the southeast, he laid sound foundations for all later Great Basin work. Witty and sometimes sarcastic, Jennings preferred data and digging to theories. His excavations set standards for a generation. Meanwhile, in eastern North America, Kansas-born James B. Griffin, 1905-97, of the University of Michigan, also helped transform North American archaeology. Griffin was, above all, an artifact man. He spent a great deal of time studying the enormous collections assembled by the River Basin surveys. Like Ford and Willey, Griffin tried to bring order to storage rooms full of unsorted artifacts. His knowledge of archaeological finds in eastern North America was legendary. He founded a ceramic repository at the University of Michigan. This vast pottery collection is a fundamental archive for today's researchers. By the early 1960s, a general framework for the North American past before Columbus was in widespread use. It was based on excavations, surveys, and artifacts. Like Gordon Child in Europe, those who developed it assumed, quite reasonably, that the distribution of human cultures over wide areas meant that they flourished at much the same time. Griffin, Jennings, and Willey were, above all, data experts. However, as Willey with his VRU research well knew, change was afoot. A new generation of archaeologists was aware of research into ancient environments, pioneered in the Southwest by, among others, A.E. Douglas of Tree Ring fame. See Chapter 24. They began to ask new questions, some of them arising from the River Basin surveys. How had environments and landscapes changed through time? How had human societies living in them adapted to such changes? What impacts did the need for such adjustments have on society as a whole? North American archaeology from the 1930s to the early 1960s was mostly a matter of describing the past, classifying minor details of different tools, and defining changing societies on the basis of their technologies. Few people thought about why these cultures had changed. Why, for example, had people taken up agriculture instead of hunting, fishing, and collecting plant foods? Why were some hunting and gathering societies, like those in the Pacific Northwest, more complex than those in, say, the Great Basin or Central Alaska? The new generation wanted to move beyond classification to more sophisticated approaches to the past. They were also looking for new ways of dating ancient societies. It was one thing to say that one culture was older than another, but how old were they both in calendar years? How much older in years was one than another? As we shall see, the development of radiocarbon dating, Chapter 27, was part of a major revolution in archaeology that was about to take place. Until the 1950s, the center of gravity of archaeology had rested in Europe and the Mediterranean, and also in southwestern Asia. Gradually, archaeological research expanded far from European shores. The process had long been underway, in part because of the global distribution of British and French colonies. Both archaeology and anthropology had been activities associated with colonial rule, whether in India, Africa, or the Pacific. The roots of what came to be called world prehistory had been put down in the 19th century. Now, world prehistory was to blossom.